something completely different. It was on this day, back in 1811, this very day, when a group of American fur traders arrived by ship at the mouth of the Columbia River, and in honor of this occasion, our resident historian Felix Bunnell has set aside our usual news format and prepared a little historical sketch to highlight the history and human drama that played out in the founding of Astoria. Are we ready for this,
people? Yeah, I hope we didn't over-rehearse this. We tend to spend so much time in the strict rehearsals of these that the plays lose their life. I hope that didn't happen this time. All right, I'm going to just get right into it here. It was March 22nd, 1811. The American bark Tonquin, 96 feet long, built in New York in 1807, sailed into view of the mouth of the great river of the West, the mighty Columbia. Aboard was a group of fur traders, financed by American entrepreneur John Jacob Astor, and known as the Pacific Fur Company. Their objective was to establish a post and begin trading with indigenous people for furs to export to the Far East and compete against British interests doing the same. The man in charge of the ship was a strict disciplinarian. His name was Captain Jonathan Thorne, and his character had become clear not long after the Tonquin left New York the previous September.
Astor's men spend all their time laying about on the deck and writing in their journals. When it's lights out, it means it's off with your lamps. Now! If any man shall disobey me, I shall blow his brains out!
I wasn't the only one who didn't take kindly to being told to snuff my candle at eight bells. It's very important that I document every step of this long journey.
That's Ross Cox, one of at least three fur traders on board the Tonquin who later published their accounts of life on the ship with Captain Thorne and of the attempt to settle and found what would become Astoria. And this was just 5 years after Lewis and Clark had explored the same area.
If you ask me, the whole voyage around the Cape was cursed with trouble on account of Captain Thorne.
No, that's not a member of the Star Trek's crew. That's another of the many scribes aboard the ship, Gabriel Franchera.
It's the Falkland Islands where we stopped for fresh water. Thorne was set sail through. He knew he'd left behind eight of my shipmates. Eight good men, abandoned.
The behavior of those men threatened the success of our endeavors, and they deserved to be left behind. Had the wind not hauled ahead soon after leaving the harbor's mouth, I should positively have left them for good. They seem to have no idea the value of property, nor any regard for Mr. Astor's interest.
Ah, those poor fellows had but oars. They were forced to row for dear life for more than 3 hours to catch up with the ship. When we hauled them aboard, their palms were raw and bloodied.
As I say, let the punishment fit the crime. Their own dallying was the cause of their fate, and they deserved it.
Aye, perhaps. But no one deserved to die in pursuit of profits.
That's the chief mate, old Mr. Fox. Captain Thorne was imperious over those many months between New York and the Northwest Coast, but his actions became downright deadly at the mouth of the mighty Columbia, where the swell was continuous, and the monstrous waves and maniacal winds gave a sense of foreboding that even the most ignorant sailor couldn't ignore.
I need a man to get in one of the whaleboats and lead us into the river! The bar is treacherous, and the proper channel isn't obvious from the ship, so there's no other option! You there!
Frank, do you mean me?
Yes, you, Fox. As I say, take the whaleboat and three of the Canadians and old John and find the channel so the Tonquin can follow you into more tranquil waters upriver.
But Captain Thorne, I beg of you, the wind, the waves, I'm sure to die. May I at least take some competent sailors with me?
Nay, ye coward, do as I say. That is an order.
But Captain Thorne, that's a death sentence.
Quiet, you.
I am sent off without seamen to man my boat, in boisterous weather, on the most dangerous part of the Northwest Coast. My uncle was lost a few years ago on this same bar, and I am now going to lay my bones alongside his.
Fox and his comrades reluctantly set off in the whaleboat. All eyes were strained after the little bark as it pulled for shore, rising and sinking with the huge rolling waves until it entered, a mere speck, among the foaming breakers and was soon lost to view. Evening set in, night succeeded and passed away, and morning returned without the return of the boat.
The next day, Mr. Stewart and Mr. McKay were sent forth in the small boat known as the Pinnace to search for Mr. Fox and the others in the whaleboat. The wind and waves forced them to quickly return.
Then another party was sent out by Captain Thorne. On board the tiny boat this time were Mr. Aiken, one of the officers, the sailmaker John Coles, the armorer Stephen Weeks, and two of the Sandwich Islanders. They managed to find the channel through the bar, but then the wind and waves swept them out to sea. Only Mr. Weeks would survive. Brought them back to the ship by one of the natives, buried alive.
Somehow the wind and tide eventually helped push the ship safely into Baker's Bay on the north side of the river. After much arguing with Captain Thorne, Astor's men chose a better location on the south side, present-day site of Astoria, Oregon.
And it weren't long before Captain Thorne got his comeuppance. Just a few months later, he sailed the Toquin north, and his men on the west coast of Vancouver Island. Thorne and all the men on board were attacked and killed, and the gunpowder in the hold of the ship exploded and sank, killing at least 100 natives.
As beautiful Kitty one morning was tripping with a pitcher of milk from the fair of Corain.
Astor's effort to establish a fur trading empire at Astoria ultimately failed. When word of the War of 1812 reached them, Astor's men sold out to the British Northwest Company rather than wait to be captured by the Royal Navy. The British changed Astoria's name to Fort George in honor of their king. But Astoria came into sole American possession by the Treaty of 1846. The Columbia Bar is still one of the most treacherous spots on the Northwest Coast.
When a pitcher of milk from the Fair of Corain.
Wow. That was terrifying.
It's like am I we the were only right one there. Clapping for us? Come
yeah,
on.
That was good. That was good.
I loved all the accents. We were changing
How
it up.
How come I'm always cast as the old guy?
I was an old guy. There wasn't even a woman in this play.
Well, we had gender-neutral casting.
Exactly.
Very good.
That's right.
So this is what it took to found Astoria?
Yeah, like you had to have a guy like Captain Thorne pushing people to do their very best.
So you're on his side?
Well, he killed eight men died trying to get through the Columbia Bar in that first attempt in 1811. But what else were they going to do? Wait for the weather to change? I mean, who knows? Yeah. I mean, you can't. It's hard to judge people. What is it? 212 years later, but we'll certainly try.
Yeah. Why not? What are they going to do about it? Yeah.
So is there a memorial somewhere so that at least my character is remembered by somebody?
You know, the location of where the Tonquin actually was destroyed up on the coast of Vancouver, and that's not known exactly where that happened. That's sort of a mystery. One person survived that whole incident who was the interpreter who'd gone along on the trip, maybe one of the Chinook Indians. And later told the story about how the natives came aboard and attacked Thorne and his crew, and then the ship exploded somehow because the gunpowder in the hold went off. It's crazy.
Hmm. All right. Well, that's why we have OSHA. Felix Bunnell, all his features, including this, will probably be posted at mynorthwest.com.
You think I would have been hit up with a hostile work environment complaint?
I'm almost sure of it.
HR is going to hear about this.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. As you know, there is a crisis of confidence in the banking system, and it primarily involves banks which have been helping new companies, startups, get started. There are other ways to get companies started, and that is private equity. Drew Maloney is president and CEO of the American Investment Council. And so you know something about business startups. First of all, what's your perspective on this bank crisis? Has it been fixed, or are we going to see some more failures?
Well, Dave, I'm not a bank expert, but what I can tell you is that it seems like it's been isolated to a small number of banks. I think we have a very resilient banking sector here in the United States. Our focus at private equity is investing private capital, and I think that's sort of more important than ever now that you have this long-term capital that can invest in companies and meet the needs of these small and medium-sized businesses that require the expertise and the capital to continue to grow.
So are these people like, the investors on Shark Tank? They listen to the pitch, they decide whether they're going to throw some money at it or not?
So we take a longer-term view. There are 5,000 private equity firms sprinkled across the country. They're all shapes and sizes. And we pull the assets from pension funds, endowments, foundations, and then we invest those dollars in businesses that are seeking to expand. And we do that over a 5 or 7 year period. So one of the things that we're able to do is we're able to withstand sort of economic downturns and play through the economic upturn. So unlike the public markets that are very emotional sometimes, we can take a longer term view and provide more stability and diversity for a lot of the pension fund investments that are out there.
So it sounds like you're backing businesses that have already been proven to be successful and would like to expand. Or do you also offer these services to business owners who are just getting started?
Largely, private equity handles a more mature segment of the investment cycle. So the venture capital firms that are largely based in Silicon Valley will do the startups. And then once they mature, we will come in with more capital and more expertise to take the company to the next level.
So are you pitching this idea as a more reliable alternative to the stock market?
It's just another way to get capital. I'm not sure it's more reliable, but it's another way to get capital. And as we're thinking about anybody's portfolio, or especially a pension fund portfolio that has out there, you have the public markets, you have real estate, you have fixed income, and then you have private equity. And we're, you know, usually about 10% of that allocation. But what has been shown over years is that that allocation outperforms all others. I think in the last year, the 10-year average return for private equity was a little bit higher than 12%.
Now, that's pretty impressive. And I get pitched all the time as an alumnus. There are alumni funds now, which are sort of made up of affinity groups. So Princeton, Cornell, other colleges say, here's some private businesses you can invest in. We put together a package of businesses that basically I've never heard of. and they say, you know, we're smart enough to know to be able to separate the winners from the losers. But there's also substantial risk to this, isn't there?
Look, there's risk to any type of investing out there. But I think what you have to look at is the track record of investing in these private companies and these small businesses. But over time, the risk usually pays off. And otherwise, we wouldn't have had a 12% return over 10 years, outperforming the markets over the last 20 years. So I think, you know, we have a solid, we have a very solid record. But I think the thing that's different than, you know, there's different ways to go get capital. You can go to a bank and get a loan, or you can come work with a private equity company. And when you work with a private equity company, not only do you get the capital, but you get the expertise. You get former CEOs, former marketing executives, a lot of experts that will work side by side with the leadership of the company to address the growing needs, whether you need to expand your marketing, you need to build new facilities, you need to hire new people. We work side by side with the management teams of these companies.
What's the risk for the business? What's the success failure rate there?
We have more success than non-private equity backed businesses. So it's more than 95% of the businesses are successful in private equity. And, you know, and we really take that responsibility seriously. And we're very positive on the growth trajectory in private equity.
But a lot of people don't want to give up portions of their business for this equity. About what's on average are people giving up? How many shares?
Well, it just depends. You know, you as the owner of the company can decide that you either want to sell your entire company. Sometimes you sell 50% of the company. Sometimes you just need capital and debt in order to grow the company. So our investments are all different shapes and sizes, just depending on what the owner wants to do. We look for companies that are good ideas, good people, and have great innovation attached to them. And we approach them, and sometimes they want to sell the entire company, or sometimes it's 75% of the company. So it just depends on a case-by-case basis.
So it sounds like in this current crisis, you guys are emerging as a more appealing alternative then to bank loans?
We can provide a lot of stability, and sometimes we can take more risk than the bank is willing to take on in the current environment. And this is where, you know, if you're a small business person and you're operating a manufacturing facility and you need growth capital, you may very well partner with private equity in order to get that company to grow and be able to sell its product across the country or across the globe.
Do you have any examples of a Washington State company you've helped?
We have several examples. You know, a great example is a company called Brent Haven that is based in Seattle. They manufacture protective mobile technology cases to survive extreme conditions in the outdoors. And that happens right. And it's just a small company, but they're now selling their products beyond just Washington State, but they sought out private equity money and they're now, you know, part of the private equity family.
Drew Maloney is the president and CEO of the American Investment Council. Drew, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's get the update on the governor's housing program and the other issues facing the state legislature. Here is Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Dave. Lots to talk about this morning. Probably the most interesting I felt was Inslee's surprise visit to a camp cleanup at the First Avenue South Bridge yesterday. Now, just to set the stage, he showed up. It wasn't on a schedule. It was somewhat unannounced. He tipped off some members of the media. He didn't tip off us because we kind of maybe on that morning chastised what the plan was in our morning report yesterday. So what happened is that the Senate had passed it or just basically announced its capital budget bill, and it did not put in $4 billion like the governor would like to have for housing. It basically put in a paltry, if you want to call it paltry, $625 million. Mm-hmm. So he showed up the First South Bridge to basically do a photo op while they're cleaning up this gigantic camp that's been there for years. Part of it's on state property. The governor chastised the Senate for not following his mantra of go big or so people can go home.
That's one of my concerns about the Senate proposal. I don't see it, how we're going to do rapid housing. They're doing hundreds of millions of dollars less than we did last year. We did over $800 million in the state of Washington last year. And the Senate has proposed to do hundreds of millions of dollars less than that.
So what I think he's hoping for is that the Senate and the House basically just push forward his proposal to put it to the ballot, to a vote of the people. And he basically said out there, let the people decide.
And what I am asking the legislators to do is listen to the people. Let the people vote. This would go to a vote of the people. What's wrong with letting Washington citizens vote on this and decide if they want to accept these encampments or not?
Well, that sounds pretty gutsy. He's willing to have put this to a referendum then.
Yeah, and he's confident that people will pass it. So that's really doubtful in terms of people who've been watching this for a while.
Yeah.
Now, I found it interesting that he wants to put it to a vote of the people. And remember the pursuit bill, Dave, and how mm-hmm. they wouldn't even want to put it to a vote of the floor of the Senate or the House? You know, Democratic lawmakers didn't like it, so they don't want to put it to a vote. You know, they have the control. So here's the governor asking for that put it to a vote of the people of the state. And at the same time yesterday, the Republicans in the House are basically saying, you know, we have that pursuit bill in our House. They want to force the J.T. Wilcox, the Republican leader, wants the Speaker of the House to put it to a vote of the floor of the House, just like Inslee wants to put his bill, his ideas, to a vote of the entire state. Now, this is what J.T. Wilcox said yesterday about putting the pursuit bill to a vote.
If we reach the end of that road and they've ignored every single opportunity to bring it up for a floor vote, then darn right, we're going to offer every member of their caucus an opportunity to vote on whether or not we bring it up to the floor. And they deserve that.
Now, I thought they'd come to a compromise on the pursuit bill.
Well, they had a last second move by the Senate to propose a bill that was dead for a long time, and that passed. And now the House had a same version. They never put it to a vote of the floor. So now the Senate version is back in the House, and the House is facing the same dilemma again, voting on basically a similar bill. They're getting a second shot at it. And now the Republicans are saying, you know, we're going to stand on the sidelines, Democrats, and see if you guys can argue enough to at least put it to a vote of the floor and maybe make some changes, but put it to a vote of the floor. Otherwise, we're going to do some parliamentary moves to force a vote and make it sure that everybody knows who's not wanting to have a vote on the pursuit bill.
Okay, my memory's a little foggy on this, but didn't we talk to Monica Dingru, who basically changed her mind and said we had to make it at least a little easier for some pursuits to take place? And she's a Democrat, so I thought the Democrats had agreed on that.
Well, on the Senate side, about the House. So, you know, the bill.
So the House Democrats feel differently.
Yes, they had something similar. She basically crafted the pursuit bill to match what was in the House, but the House never ended up voting on it. The Democrats' leadership never put it to a vote of the floor, and it died. So now that same bill that they killed, it'll just let die on the vine, is now before them again, and the Republicans are sitting there letting the Democrats argue behind the scenes about whether to put it to the floor of the vote.
Well, I get that. I'm just trying to figure out why the Democrats are still arguing about this. Because mood of the public has changed, I think, hasn't it?
Well, you would think, but because of all the publicity this has gotten, but that idea that if you allow for more pursuits, more innocent people are going to die, and that's the big debate.
All right. On limits for child abuse cases.
Now, this is a precedent-setting bill here. This is it passed the House 82-14, and now it's in the Senate. Let me just tell you, let's just listen to Courtney Butler, how she testified how her soccer coach allegedly molested her as a teen, but she didn't come forward because she was afraid.
I wanted nothing to do with ever coming forward, and I vowed that I would rather kill myself than ever tell anybody what had happened to me.
So she testified for this bill that basically eliminates the statute of limitations for civil actions for injuries suffered as a result of childhood abuse or sexual abuse that continues in adulthood if the sexual abuse is part of a pattern of childhood sexual abuse. Now, currently, the statute of limitation is 3 years, and that was passed in 1991. And that depends on a variety of factors, but it's 3 years. This would eliminate the statute of limitation. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, maybe, and this is the real precedent-setting part, it applies retroactively to all claims of action and proceedings, regardless of when the claim or cause of action took place.
I see.
Basically, it's going back. If you never filed a claim of sexual abuse that happened 50 years ago, you can do that now. And basically includes claims against all parties who fail to protect a child. You can file a claim against a school, a state agency, a church, a parent, someone who had a special relationship with a child. Now, Democratic Representative Daria Farivar is proposing dropping the statute of limitations and making it entirely retroactive.
I admit that it does sound like a lot all at once, but I will measure that by saying that we would not be the first. This is a movement across the country.
Now, Maine and Vermont have done the same. Of course, the attorneys who represent the school districts and whatnot, the churches, they don't like it. Kerry Silverman represents attorneys of the American Tort Reform Association.
Our first concern is the bill's complete abandonment of the statute of limitations, which is unprecedented. And while some may view statutes of limitations as arbitrary, they serve a critical purpose. They're there to allow judges and juries to evaluate liability when the best evidence is available, before records are tossed away and before witnesses disappear.
Now, Renee Williams of the National Crime Victim Bar Association talks about what's really at the heart of the bill.
All too often, statutes of limitations have allowed institutions that have long protected predators to escape any legal consequences for their direct knowledge of abuse, while victims are forced to bear the emotional and financial costs.
But you still have to prove that the abuse took place, right?
Correct. Yeah. But the argument being, and we're going to skip the last element there, Dave. The argument being is that the paperwork going back 50 years to defend a church or a school or a person in an abuse case simply doesn't exist because companies were never told to hold on to this kind of potential evidence, because there would, once the statute of limitations is over, you figure you're not going to be charged with a crime at that point. So that's the big issue here. If you file an abuse case going so far back against somebody who wasn't keeping the paperwork at the time, and it doesn't exist anymore. So the retroactive part of this is just gigantic. And again, she says there's a move going through this. Again, Maine and Vermont are the only two states that have actually done this. This is a big ask, but like I said, it passed the House 82-14, and it can really change in a big way how child abuse is prosecuted in this state.
Matt Markovich covering the legislature for us. Matt, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored by Robert W. Baird. There are people who do good deeds every day in this Ohio community. Jerry Tongis, a contractor in Napoleon, Ohio, owns JT's Building and Construction. He's just one of those people. He said he's not one for the limelight, but one of Jerry's recent customers refused to let his work go unnoticed. Jamie Wyrick's dad had knee replacement surgery last month and is currently using a wheelchair. It's his second knee replacement, so he's done this before, but the recovery on this one not going as quickly as expected. The Weyricks tell CBS affiliate WTOL-TV they needed a ramp for his house in just a matter of days.
I called about 50 contractors, and three of them got back with me. And one of which was Jerry with JT Buildings.
Jerry got right to work. He went to their home to get the measurements, then got the materials and built the ramp in just a few hours. When the Weyricks tried to pay him for his time and work, he said, that's all right.
There was no cost. It came to the point where it was minimal dollars, and it was a good gesture that I just felt I had to do for her.
And that was a shock to the family, especially since other contractors told them it would take weeks to get the ramp and cost them thousands of dollars.
I felt like my thank yous weren't enough for him because he really, really helped our family in such dire need in such short time frame.
Jerry says he just likes to give back. And there's a reason for his generosity.
I've been going through the same thing similar to what with my fiance. She has multiple myeloma cancer. So we were trying to give back to the community. She's doing well.
And he believes he was meant to cross paths with the Weyricks.
I've done multiple ramps for people, but it's just it hit me that it's like, you know, let's do something good for a change because we don't have a lot of good in the world right now.
If you can, why not do? Jerry hopes his act of kindness can inspire others to bring a similar light to other people's lives.
7:48, and now from the Gio Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock, here's G. Scott looking at the Seahawks offseason moves. All I see here is a bunch of names I don't recognize, so help me through this.
It's all good. Shelby Harris, Al Woods, L.J. Collier, and Quentin Jefferson. They were one of the mainstays out there on the defensive line for the Seattle Seahawks last year. They're no longer here right now. They did not re-sign Shelby Harris. They just cut Al Woods, which he was one of the captains. That's kind of a shocker. L.J. Collier, who was one of their first-round draft picks, who in my opinion, he hasn't really had a good career. He just signed with the Arizona Cardinals the other day. And Quentin Jefferson, he had been here for a few years, and he was here before. They're no longer here. In the offseason so far, they have signed over Draymond Jones from the Denver Broncos and gave him the highest free agent salary that they've ever given to someone. They gave him $51 million for 3 years, Colleen.
Oh, what does he do?
That's great.
He's a defensive lineman.
Okay.
Yeah, he's trying to get the quarterback. And then they also brought back Jaron Reed. He used to be here with the Seahawks. Went to the Kansas City Chiefs. Then he was with the Green Bay Packers. Now he's back here again. So here's what's happening. I think that John Schneider and Pete Carroll are having an amazing offseason. I told you guys this. They are in real control right now. Imagine they are paying their bills, setting up their bills on auto pay with actual money in the account.
Okay.
How'd they do that?
You know what I mean? That says a lot. Yeah. One of the hardest ways, you know when it's hard to pay bills? We ain't got no money.
Right.
But the Seahawks right now, they have time, they have patience, they have money. And right now they are playing with house money. And why do I say they're playing with house money? Because let me go back to a year ago when the Seahawks had traded away Russell Wilson, when the Seahawks had cut Bobby Wagner. Just remember, for a second, how were we feeling?
We were
what
is going on?
Oh, they're rebuilding. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. This is over. This is all this stuff. But then Geno Smith, not only is he really good, he is comeback player of the year. He is a Pro Bowler. The Seahawks win, go to the playoffs. That right there is house money. So now you're going into this year. You have two rookies on the corners. You have Charles Cross and you have Abraham Lucas, right? Those are two rookies last year, starting rookies on the offensive line. Then in the secondary, you have Tariq Woolen. You have Kobe Bryant. You have a very good secondary. Rookies. So, and you also have a rookie running back. So what I'm trying to say is that last year, according to the experts, according to maybe some of us, maybe not according to the Seahawks, they had a really good year, and now they're building off that. They have the number 5 pick in the draft coming up.
When's the draft?
Like May, beginning of May, end of April, beginning of May. They have the number 5 pick. They have the number 20 pick. They have 2 picks.
Don't they need somebody who can run a lot?
They all can run, Dave.
I don't know, Our run game has never been great.
Oh, the kind of guy who can find those little slots and just sort of, you know, disappear and
Russell,
turn
right?
up in the end zone.
Ken Walker III was number 2 for Offensive Rookie of the Year, mm-hmm. right? So, anyways, the defensive line is, they're basically saying, so if you're listening like, yeah, but gee, yeah, I've been saying they need to take care of that defensive line. Well, so that's what they're doing. Done. I mean, sometimes, and I always like to talk about remodeling because it's just fun to talk about. When you start getting old, you like looking at TV shows, watching remodeling.
Because you got that brand new kitchen.
Yeah, that too. So, but hey, Colleen, you can go in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Hey, we need to redo the kitchen.
Is that how I sound?
Okay, no.
Hey,
no.
We need to redo the kitchen.
But you could get rid of the mats.
Yeah.
You change that out. Do a little paint job. You could paint the cabinets. You can do that. Or you can go in there and just tear everything out.
Right.
That's what the Seahawks
are
doing.
The D-line,
they said, get rid of everything. We're going to get some new cabinets.
I like the confidence.
New sink, new countertops.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Who's Gino in the kitchen remodel? He's the kitchen island. Or is he the gas grill?
No. Do you know that's a good question?
Refrigerator?
You know what Gino is? Gino is the quartz backsplash.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, not a lot of people really think to put that much money into that thing. They just think you just go get something to stick them up there.
But it pays off.
But it pays off when you make a little investment in the minor details. That quartz backsplash right there.
All right.
Now I'm hungry. What's for dinner?
See you guys.
See you in Ursula at 9 o'clock. 8:47 Seattle's Morning News. How desperate are we for concert tickets? Some people, like Colleen, are so desperate they'll cross the ocean to see a concert.
I did.
Yeah, you did. Mickey Gomez is here to explain what she's going to do. Mickey?
Well, it's not what I'm going to do. It's what Beyonce fans are doing here in America. They're so frustrated with paying high prices for concert tickets. They're flying to Europe to see Beyonce because it's cheaper. Or it's
Seriously?
About the same price. Yes, it is. And what a better way to see your favorite artist. I mean, if you're going to pay $1,000 to see Beyonce, and I mean $1,000 at the low end, make a girl's trip out of it, fly to Europe. According to NBC News, this sort of thing kind of started in 2018 and, you know, right before the pandemic. And one TikToker says that her name is Ariel. She's a content creator. She saw Beyonce and Jay-Z at the On the Run 2 tour in Paris, and her tickets were $92 a piece. She was on
what?
The floor. Yes, she was on the floor. She had Beyonce sweat on her. Had she bought those tickets in Dallas, she would have paid upwards of $900.
How? How was it so cheap in Paris?
Well, it's cheaper in Paris because the laws there for resale tickets in Europe are very different.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the laws there are very different.
Spineless Congress won't do anything.
Yes. And not only that, but fans who can't get tickets to their favorite shows here because of Ticketmaster debacles are also crossing the pond to see their favorite bands perform. And so, you know, I love what she says. Ariel says, it's really important to me to make people aware that living within your means does not mean that your lifestyle cannot be fabulous or that you can't go to these glowing moments that will forever be memories. And that makes me think about your trip across the pond to go see the Foo Fighters, Colleen.
Yeah, the tribute concert for their drummer, Taylor Hawkins, who passed away. And, you know, granted, it wasn't as cheap as $92, but it definitely was one of those things where my husband and I looked at each other, and even if the ticket, you know, whether the tickets were expensive or not, we had to go because it was a once in a lifetime experience to see members of Queen and Rush and all of the classic rock bands pay tribute to Taylor Hawkins. So I think for me, it has been more memorable than any concert I've seen locally.
I love your pictures. I love the video content from that concert. It was just quite emotional. And just so you know, her concert tickets were $92. I believe her trip was $900 a piece. So for flights and hotel, I priced it. Let's say we want to go see Beyonce overseas. Airfare, hotel, and tickets, $1,400.
My goodness. For one person.
That's... But tickets here in the United States to see Beyonce are going to be upwards of $900 to $2,000. And that's if you don't buy them resale.
Yeah, so let's go to Europe.
Yes, exactly. So $1,400. You make a trip. You stay for 4 days.
Yeah.
You stay in a pretty decent 4-star hotel in London. You're good to go. And I just found out that Lollapalooza just announced that it's coming back. The lineup is exceptional. And yes, Lollapalooza is going to be performing in, I believe, 7 countries.
Oh.
So, and you can only imagine what ticket prices are going to be here in the U.S. Well, you can pay the same to fly to Europe and see them for cheaper.
This is an incredible life hack.
It's
crazy. It's like pharmaceuticals. How come everything's cheaper in Europe because they have rules that say you can't gouge patrons.
Right, right. But the reason why ticket prices in the U.S. are so expensive is because of the cost of the production. And this is according to my research that I did with NBC News. They say that the extra fees that get tacked on, those hidden fees, service charges, those add up. Also, reseller fees and markups and inflation.
This country is out of control. Sorry, this is just one more thing.
So we're basically, we are basically subsidizing the low prices in Europe.
I guess we
are. Is that what it is?
Sure. Why not?
Or they have a government who will actually help people. You know, when Ticketmaster had that whole Taylor Swift debacle,
that wouldn't have flown
like,
in. That
would have we're not going to get involved. This is Ticketmaster's thing. They got to figure it out. We're not going to get involved. Well, this is what happens.
Right.
That's because Americans are suckers. They'll pay anything.
It's all about the experience. You know, we want to go see our favorite artists. I mean, I think it's called, we've got revenge travel. We've got revenge shopping. We've got revenge everything because of the pandemic. And, you know, I haven't seen Duran Duran, I don't think, since the last time they went on tour. And Duran Duran is coming back and they're going to be at Climate Pledge Arena. And I know that concert tickets are pretty expensive right now. We're trying to buy a house. So it's the one concert that I'm going to allow myself to go to and splurge a little bit. Yeah. $200 a piece for a ticket. I got to see John Taylor. I have to see Simon Le Bon and Nick Rhodes. So $400 plus the Uber or the Lyft.
Yeah. And it's one of those bands, too, where you think, I don't know when I'm going to be able to see. And that was our also part of the traveling to see the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium was, you know, with the drummer dead, we didn't know if this would be the last time we'd see Dave Grohl on stage. Now, thankfully, they've signed up for more festivals, and we're thinking about maybe going to like Alabama or someplace we've never been to see him.
Chris, you ever paid $200
for a concert?
I'm looking
at Sully's face, and he looks disgusted. He's like, "That's just ridiculous."
Yeah, nope, no, nothing's worth that kind of money.
I think you got to be like a big music buff to do that kind of stuff.
I'm a big music fan. I even told my daughter, I said, "If you want to go to a concert, let's go. I'll take you." But maybe I'll take her to Europe to go see one of her favorite.
What if it was a Simpsons festival, Chris?
No, because I've seen it all.
What if it was your favorite football team?
Well, I mean, I do that anyway, but I still wouldn't travel like that or pay. I mean, you got to live within your means.
Well, we are.
So, we are. You know? Well, yeah.
Nobody's saying spend your life savings.
Right.
What she's saying is that it's cheaper to go to Europe than it is to see your artist here.
Absolutely. If you don't have $1,400 to go see the show here, then you don't have $1,400 to go to Europe.
You got to schedule time off. You know, you got to take vacation days. There are things to consider.
You leave on
here.
A Thursday. You take a couple of days off, Chris. You come back on a Monday.
Can't take it to the grave.
This is true. Right.
Things to spend money on.
We get to the grave argument, that's the end of the segment.
There you go.
I mean, that, when you think about it.
You can't take the money with you.
That's true. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.